KALW.
It's a super personal connection that I have with you, because the fleur-de-lis, I noticed it 16, 17 years ago.
Today, the story of how the promise of a burrito sparked a special connection between two Bay Area comedians.
You can basically get me to do anything if you get me a burrito.
A new episode of Into the Fold with Christy Ono. Then we're going to a half-century-old San Francisco establishment that uses sound for healing.
I always thought everyone had a dad with, you know, where I'd wake up in the morning and there'd be weird sounds coming out of the basement.
And we'll hear a reading from Pacifica author Tony Marosevic.
The narrator just simply desires to be in with this out crowd.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Our first segment today comes from Christy Ono. It's Into the Fold. Last time, the San Francisco comedian shared the story of how and why she ate 100 burritos in 100 days.
It started as an accident. I happened to eat a burrito a day for a week, as you do.
Into the Fold is Christy's recurring segment about the Bay Area burrito scene, but it's really more about the burrito community.
People say the United States is like a melting pot, but I think we should strive to be a burrito. You have black beans, you have rice, and even, you know, at a stereotypical level, like in our community, you have the rice community. You have the bean community, you know, everyone coming together wrapped in a big white thing. You don't put a burrito in a blender. It's delicious, but all of the elements are separate and coexisting. So it's a burrito is just a beautiful metaphor for what society could be.
That's Victor Escobedo, a restaurateur who has his fingerprints all over some of the Bay Area's tastiest Mexican food. Not literally, but he did have the honor of making both the 50th and the triumphant 100th burrito in Christie's Burrito-thon. Let's turn it over now to Christy to tell us how burritos led her and Victor to an unexpectedly deep friendship. And a warning before we begin, this story does discuss suicide.
I almost died a week ago.
I want you to meet my friend, Victor Escobedo.
I had a flat tire on the Bay Bridge. And so I'm like, oh my God, this is not a drill. The sensors came on my dashboard and said like 42, 39, 42. And then 20-0. So I'm like, oh my God, oh my God. And I'm going up the incline, coming to San Francisco, and it's a beautiful day, sun is setting, and I pull over to the right, and the shoulder is so narrow, and it's this slight curve, and I can see all these cars coming full on speed, and I know that they're being blinded by the sun because I'm blinded by the sun. This one guy was towing a huge boat. They came so close to me, and it's just like one of these things where if they nick you or whatever, you don't know what's going to happen. And I'm like, I'm either going to die or my life is never going to be the same. And I'm just like sitting there. I called my wife and I'm like, you know what? I think I just might die right now, like today, right now.
I'm not sure why, but in my conversations with Victor, we often end up talking about death.
And I didn't tell her this, but I was okay with it. I was like, man, I realized some time ago, maybe like in the last 5 years, that I'm going to die with unfinished projects. And that was really creating a lot of stress because when I get an idea, I act on it and I want to finish it.
And Victor gets and finishes a lot of ideas. He's the owner of Papalote Mexican Grill, Papalote Salsa, and Papalote Food Trucks. He just opened Snackeria in the heart of the Mission. He's also a stand-up comedian. I remember meeting him at an open mic he ran at Pepper Bellies in Fairfield. He remembers meeting me at an open mic at Grant Green. I encourage you to believe his memory over mine. That was a time before I was sober, and my memories are, shall we say, spotty. But I certainly remember how we became friends. It started like so many things with jokes on social media. One day, while feeling especially angsty at work, I posted that I wanted to try to get a tattoo during my lunch hour. I said I'd get whatever was the best suggestion. Victor replied, suggesting the fleur-de-lis, and offered me a burrito to do it. You can basically get me to do anything if you get me a burrito. That is how I got a fleur-de-lis tattoo on my wrist and a triple threat burrito. Quick side note, the triple threat burrito contains grilled steak, chicken, and shrimp. This is the burrito that beat Bobby Flay on his TV show Throwdown.
It's affirmation that Papalote's burrito is king, because when it comes to a food fight, no one can beat the triple threat.
But that's another story for another time. Anyway, about a month later, I went to Papalote to collect my prize, and while I was there, I got to have my first extended conversation with Victor while sober and not inside a comedy club. I showed him my new tattoo, of course, and I asked him why he suggested the fleur-de-lis.
It's a super personal connection that I have with you, because the fleur-de-lis, I noticed it 16, 17 years ago. It was everywhere. I'm like, it's everywhere. Have you guys noticed? And I like the golden ratio. And I think that the fleur-de-lis is a perfect representation of it. I've never really... Anyway, so I was looking and I was seeing it here and there. And then if I went somewhere and I was nervous, it would jump out at me. I'm like, oh, this is affirmation that this is for me. You know, almost like angel numbers, but like the fleur-de-lis. And so then I got really sick and my gut exploded and I had a colostomy bag and they told me that it's from diverticulosis and I thought I was going to die.
See, there it is again, death.
My son Jose was 2 years old back then. And so they said the colostomy bag, they would reverse it 3 months later, but if they couldn't, then I would live with it forever. And as soon as they told me that, I was going to kill myself. And then I said, Jody can get a boyfriend. She's super beautiful. She'll be fine. No one will care. Everything is good. And then I looked at my son and I was like, oh, shoot, I can't do it because of him.
The doctors told Victor that there was a chance he could die from complications. And as he contemplated what would happen to his family if he died, he remembered the fleur-de-lis. He had already started pointing it out to Jose whenever he noticed it. And he realized that this symbol of affirmation he'd been holding on to was something he could pass on.
So my goal was to show him, for him to remember me for, and this is really heavy, and I think you might have to cut it out or whatever, but who was that guy again? That was your dad. You know, who was that guy that used to show me the fleur-de-lis? So then he could see it, knowing that it's everywhere, that his dad was always present, right?
Victor told me all of this during that first conversation, over a burrito and my suddenly much more meaningful fleur-de-lis tattoo. I remember being surprised at how honest and open it all felt. The whole experience felt surprisingly and unintentionally, I don't want to sound too dramatic, but profound? I didn't even know Victor that well, and we had this bananas moment. Especially when I found myself compelled to share about how my father died by suicide. It was not something I'd ever talked about outside of my friends and family, and even then, we didn't talk about it much. Victor had inadvertently given me something I needed. I needed to hear a father talk about his children as the reason why he did not follow through with suicidal ideation. Part of me wanted to reinforce to Victor that he had made the right choice. But more than that, I felt a deeper awareness of the heavy and complicated feelings my father must have been experiencing to take his own life. All of this was during a time in my life where I was coping, not very gracefully, with my own mental health struggles. I was telling jokes about my depression and suicidal ideation on stage. But to have a different kind of weighty and emotional conversation without making a spectacle out of the darkness of it, just connecting with another person about its realness, that was meaningful. Who knew burritos could do that? It's hard for me to explain, but all the time I spent confronting death and my own mortality turned out to be life-affirming. It's what motivates me the most in my life, and I think Victor feels the same way.
That's why I wake up and I say, You know, I never plan, organize. You know, if you make a plan, that's expectations, and you're gonna be upset. You can have a goal and work towards and organize your day every day. Who's still with me? Who still believes in me? How can they help me? How can I help them?
We wind up talking about life purpose and being responsible for the people and community that make it possible to pursue that reason for being. When death is just something that will happen one day, I feel free to explore anything. I don't worry about rushing towards it. I only worry about what to do in the meantime.
You know, it's like all these goals, they're like a lighthouse, you know, and ships never touch the lighthouse. It's the goal, but you don't have to touch it and achieve it even to be grateful to it, you know?
As we talk, the true significance of Victor's brush with death on the Bay Bridge starts to sink in. I realize what a gift it is to be part of this roller coaster of life, death, and burritos. While we're here, there's so much to appreciate. Everyone is here to contribute their flavor, their freshness, and their identity. We can be this delicious burrito together, and I hope we all stick around for it.
That piece was by Christy Ono. It's the second episode in her series Into the Fold about her adventures with the Bay Area burrito community. You can hear her story from the beginning at KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. If you've ever longed for a moment of peace, but not quiet, you're in luck. San Francisco has a one-of-a-kind theater that uses sound and space to offer healing through introspection. The place is called Audium, and they've been at it for nearly 50 years. They stopped their shows in 2020 because of COVID, and then they used that downtime to reinvent before reopening. Joshua Sorotiak has their story in this piece from our archives.
Ever since he was born, Dave Schaff has been surrounded by sound.
Yeah, you know, I always make that joke about, you know, I always thought everyone had a dad with, you know, where I'd wake up in the morning and there'd be weird sounds coming out of the basement at like 10 a.m., 9 a.m.
He remembers going on drives with his father.
And he would like be quizzing me just kind of like when we'd be listening to the radio, like, what instrument do you hear and what instrument is that? You know, I'd be listening to a record.
Dave's dad is Stan Schaff. In the 50s and 60s, Stan was playing trumpet and hanging out with musicians from the San Francisco Tape Music Center. It was a hotbed for experimental music, theater, and dance. Stan started playing with a dance troupe.
I played the trumpet at the beginning, and I often wonder what would it be like if I could play in one spot and hear myself coming from above my head or over in a corner or spinning around the space.
These experiences got Stan thinking about sound and music in visual and spatial terms. He was thinking of space, or a sound's location, as a co-equal element within music, on par with melody, rhythm, and harmony. He wanted to be able to move the sound of his trumpet around a venue, the same way a dancer would move their body.
And I wanted to, and Doug also, wanted to have a situation where the space itself became an extension of your feelings. Like a performer of any instrument, we wanted to literally perform the element of space under our touch.
Doug is Doug McKechern, an electronically inclined fellow teacher and musician that Stan met and started collaborating with around this time.
And so in the analog world, that was extremely difficult to do, and Doug had to literally invent ways of switching, panning, that began to make the board into an instrument rather than merely just place the sound here for an effect.
Stan and Doug started with a setup of 16 portable speakers. They installed them for performances around San Francisco and eventually moved into an old lodge hall in the Inner Richmond District. In 1972, the pair got a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts. It allowed them to buy and modify an old bakery on Bush Street in San Francisco, where the theater sits to this day. Over the next 45 years, the Audium Show would go through 10 iterations, with live performances every weekend. What you're hearing now is some of Audium 11.
Audio opens up this world of understanding the way we relate to the world around us in a different way. So you hear something on the street, you hear something in your house, you hear something in your headphones. It evokes these memories. You hear things in a different way.
That's Paul Barton, and his day job is as a nuclear engineer at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratories. He first attended an Audium performance in 2016. Paul was so enthralled by his first Audium experience that he decided on the spot that he needed to be involved, and he was in luck. The Shafts were looking for someone with a technical background. They needed help mapping and updating the maze of wires and switches that Doug McEachern had created over 40 years working with Stan. Paul started talking with the Shafts and coming in regularly. After about a year, he got keys to the building. Now he's Audium's director of technology.
But one of the cool things about COVID was that it actually, I mean, it closed us down, which was horrible. And you know, for financial reasons, it was not easy. But we got a chance to dig into the system that we've been thinking about for a long time to be able to modernize the technology.
Since returning to San Francisco in 2013, Dave Schaff had been steadily taking over from his father at Audium. The theater shutting down for the past year has allowed him and Paul to really dig into the system without the worry of having it operational for each week's shows. They've installed a new digital mixing board, replacing the bespoke analog one that Doug created. They've also increased the total number of audio channels in the venue and made those channels controllable from a computer. It all adds up to a much more dynamic performance. All the changes are also allowing Dave to focus on turning Audium into the community resource for artists that he had envisioned while traveling the world in his youth. It took him years to learn the idiosyncrasies of the sound system that his dad and Doug McEachern developed. But now...
We're actually still in the process of designing this new sound movement board. And it's not really going to be a board. It's going to be many different pieces of hardware. You know, anybody, you can bring in your Wii controller and plug and play, basically. So it's going to open up the field to all different artists and composers to be able to come in here and play with the system.
In particular, the national protests that resulted from George Floyd's murder have Dave focused on diversifying the communities that are represented at Audium.
And I'm also very kind of like cognizant of the fact that for many years, this was just my dad and Doug, and they're both two white guys, and they're both coming from kind of electronic music tradition, which is very much like white. So we're trying to open that up to everybody from the Bay Area.
Dave's begun collaborating with several artists from different communities around the Bay. The first of those collaborations is in the works for this fall. It will be the first time that an artist other than one of the Shafts is running the show at Audium. But now that Dave's in charge, it won't be the last. In San Francisco, I'm Joshua Sirodiak for Cross Currents.
Joshua is a graduate of KALW's Audio Academy, class of 2020. He began reporting that story just before the pandemic shut down theaters and live music events across the state. Audium has since reopened with its first ever residency program with new work from three local artists. You can find information about how to check that out at KALW.org. Thank you.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Next, an author shares a reading about navigating your way through a new community. It's another episode from KALW's literary podcast, New Arrivals.
This is New Arrivals, a pocket-sized book tour with Bay Area authors. I'm Lisa Morehouse. Toni Marosevich lives in Pacifica. Her book of linked stories, Spell Heaven, came out on April 26th, 2022.
The book is about a couple's move to a seacoast town, and the narrator soon finds a community of people living near the sea's edge. And the narrator just simply desires to be in with this out crowd. Walking down the pier, I see empty bucket after empty bucket. Not one bent pole. Nothing's biting. I pass a guy leaning against the railing, having a smoke. "Hey there," I say. "Good luck today." He gives me a go-to-hell look. I don't know why, but right then I decide to tell everyone good luck, as if that'll make a difference. Just saying those two words, one after another, to every person, group, family, I say it. Good luck. Good luck. Let today be a good one. Maybe they're out here wishing to leave yesterday's trials behind. The bitter work battle, the fight with the crummy neighbor. Or maybe they want better times for themselves and their loved ones, or maybe just a crab or two. Are they hoping, as I'm now hoping, that if we repeat and repeat these words and say them with an open heart, that something might be different this time? Let it be different. We're all out together on the pier, and strife and unhappiness are beaten back for a day. As the fog is beaten back, as time is beaten back, as doubt and fear are beaten back. It doesn't cost anything to wish someone good luck.
That was Toni Marosevich reading from Spell Heaven.
New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse. You can hear more authors reading from their books at kalw.org/newarrivals. Before we go, here's some Bay Area music.
Because I broken any promise that I told when I sowed them seeds and soaked them in gasoline and burned them. By way of my nature, flame tree, gnarled thing with R.I.P. scarring etched beneath my leaves, inside hearts that bleed sap.
This is Amani Jade. She'll be playing at San Francisco's Bottom of the Hill tomorrow.
And they cut me down, timber. Oh, hurt, convert, hurt in the holy space. Confuse comforting with grace. Confuse supportive with support. Beam can depend on me, turn codependent. Yes, that's my biggest.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Hanisha Harjani, Lucen Mendel, Raphael Cohen, James Rowlands, Victor Tenz, Shirin Adil, Shaya Levitt, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
That keeps me sound while detoxing, pulling.